We will begin today a series of six explorations of Israel's sixth prime minister, Menachem Begin, who to my mind is really one of the most extraordinary characters in Zionist history and Israeli history. And what we'll try to do together is to not only learn the story of his life, but to try to understand what motivated him, what animated him, why he was really so different from almost every other Israeli politician in history, certainly all Israeli prime ministers. When I wrote a biography of Begin a number of years ago, I wanted to call it Menachem Begin, Israel's Jewish Prime Minister. Needless to say, the publisher did not go for that. I think they could imagine all kinds of legal issues coming up. But the truth is that in a real way, he was Jewish in a way that none of Israel's other prime ministers have been. And we want to try to unpack a little bit about where that came from, how that manifested itself, and what its implications for Israel are today. Because Begin arrived in Palestine in 1942, as we'll see towards the end of today's session, and he will, as we'll see in the sixth, passes away in 1992, the story of his life in Palestine is really, in a certain sense, the story of the history of Israel. Between 1942 and 1992, Israel is established, reaches maturity, reaches a certain amount of stability. So in a way, we'll be exploring Menachem Begin, but we're also going to be talking about the unfolding and the development of the Jewish state. And what we'll try to do, therefore, is to talk both about him and, in parallel, the country that he helped create and the values that he left behind. Our story begins in the summer of 1913, specifically in August 1913, on a Shabbat 4 days after Tisha B'Av. So that means that it's Shabbat Nachamu, the Shabbat of comforting, which is the Shabbat that always comes right after Jews commemorate the destruction of the two temples. And his parents named him Menachem because it was Shabbat Nachamu. They named him the Comforter, which I think we'll see is actually an extraordinary name for a person who did what he did. He was the youngest of three children. His oldest sister, Rachel, had been born in 1907. His older brother, Herzl, which also tells you something about the family and its values, was born in 1910. And he was, as we said, born in 1913. A little bit of history, but we'll try to do as we go through is drop little hints at the beginning so we can kind of tie them together later on in his life. As we probably know already, later in his life, he will have a very complex relationship with Ariel Sharon, who will be commanding the forces in Lebanon in the 1980s, and which will lead really to the end of Begin's career. So it's interesting to note that Ariel Sharon's grandmother was the midwife at his birth. So the Scheinerman family, which becomes the Sharon family, and the Begins are intertwined in all sorts of lots of ways, which is really very interesting. He is born and raised in Brisk, which is today called Brest. It's in Belarus. It was called sometimes Brist-Litovsk. It's called all different kinds of things because it moves from one ownership to another. In 1915, it moves to the Germans. In 1918, it becomes part of the very short-lived Belarusian Democratic Republic, and in 1919, it moves back to Poland. These are, of course, the years of the First World War. So Menachem Begin is born in 1913, really on the eve of the First World War, and he comes of age between the two world wars. And it's very important for us to think about that in terms of the values that are going to animate him and the way that he's going to see the Jewish people, Jewish history, Zionism, and so forth. His family flees Brisk. In the early parts of the war, for obvious reasons, and they live in an abandoned country house for some time. His father chops wood, his father does all sorts of things, but essentially they are destitute. And what's interesting is that in his later life, when he talked about his childhood, people obviously became very interested in his childhood once he became a world figure. He talked about those years as being poor economically, but he remembered them as years of tremendous joy with his family. He remembered, for example, with some irony, that during the First World War, when they were living in this cottage, his mother would sometimes take him out to hunt for things, to gather wood, to get vegetables, whatever it was. And if they needed a ride somewhere, German soldiers who were fighting in the First World War would actually pick them up, give them a ride wherever they were going. When you think about how Jewish history unfolded and how the relationship of the Begin family unfolded with the Germans, this image of Menachem Begin as a young child kind of with his mother in this pastoral setting getting a ride from German soldiers is the height of irony. In 1918, his father, Zev Dov Begin, returns to Brisk, and the family follows him a year later. The city was in utter ruins, but the Begin family made their way back to life there and lived for the rest of the older families' lives in Brisk till really the very, very end, of course, which comes with the Nazis. Now, we can't understand Menachem Begin unless we understand his father even more than his mother in this particular case. His father was a very unique individual. He had studied with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the head of the Brisker movement. Those people who know something about Talmud study know that the Brisker world was known for really two different things. One was a kind of a punctilious observance of mitzvot, taking Jewish commandments very seriously, and one was a kind of a hyper-rational approach to the study of the Talmudic text. They were kind of a very deep legal analysis. So Zev Dov Begin had actually studied with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik and learned a tremendous amount from him, but had not actually adopted the punctiliousness of religious practice that the elder Soloveitchik undoubtedly would have wanted him to. And I mention this only because it is going to figure very dramatically in Menachem Begin's own religious worldview later in life. But for example, now just going back to Menachem Begin's youth, his father would tell him and his siblings that they should brush their teeth on Yom Kippur morning, which we don't do. Not, by the way, because it's considered drinking, but because it's actually considered technically washing. But it doesn't matter. Traditional Jews don't brush their teeth on Yom Kippur morning. And their father told them, you got to brush your teeth before you go to shul. And he would tell them, you just don't go to talk to God with your breath smelling really bad. There's something kind of humorous about it, but I actually mention it only because there's something non-conventional about it also. To see yourself as a kind of a Talmid of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, but yet to teach your kids that they should brush their teeth on Yom Kippur morning. With Menachem's older sister, Rachel, there was another very interesting thing, which also gives you an insight into the way the Begin family thought about tradition, which was that they studied in high school in Polish schools, which we'll come back to in a little bit. But when they studied in Polish schools, not surprisingly, there were exams that were given on Shabbat. Menachem himself, we'll come back to this, did not take those exams on Shabbat, interestingly enough, but his sister did. And the reason his sister did was that her father told her to. And here was the halachic calculation. An education is critical to making a living. Making a living is critical to staying alive. Therefore, this exam, which is critical to your education and getting grades and moving on, is really critical to your staying alive. Therefore, taking this exam constitutes some form of pikuach nefesh, of keeping yourself alive, saving a life on Shabbat. Saving a life halachically trumps Shabbat, and therefore you should take the exam. Now, anybody that knows anything about the way that halacha works knows that that's a little bit loosey-goosey with halacha. Most people don't speak that way about taking exams on Shabbat. But again, I mention it here not for its entertainment value, but because it'll tell us a tremendous amount about Menachem Begin's ability to be somewhat part of the very traditional world, and in a lot of ways not part of the very traditional world, which will enable him to build relationships with all different kinds of people, which is becoming less and less possible in Israeli politics today. Both during the time that they had fled Brisk and were living out in the wilds, so to speak, and during the time that they were in Brisk, it was a passionately Jewish and Zionist household. Begin attested of his father that his father basically knew the entire Tanakh by heart. That's at least what Begin himself later said. And he said that at the family dinner table, they would play a game, and the kids would open up a Tanakh, and they would read the first part of a pasuk, they would read the first part of a verse, and they would expect their father to prove that he could finish the verse without looking at a text, obviously. Now, whether it's literally correct or it was a kind of a memory that spoke about the deep love for Tanakh, those of us who know Begin, and all of us will later on see, that it's impossible to hear a speech of Begin's without numerous literary allusions, both to Tanakh and to rabbinic literature. That's true of great Israeli figures politically. It's true of great Israeli figures, obviously, even literarily. If you read Agnon from back in the day, or even if you read David Grossman today, the literary allusions to Tanakh, and in Grossman's case, by the way, even to rabbinic literature, are profound. That's part of what makes a speech or a novel or a poem a particularly Jewish speech or knowledge or poem, not just that it happens to be in Hebrew, or not just that it happens to be said or given in Palestine or Israel, but it's really kind of the continuation of an ongoing discourse with ancient texts. And Begin, as we'll come to see later in his career, sees his entire life as a life that is in discourse with the earliest stages of the Jewish people. So his father brought them up in a world in which the love of Tanakh was paramount, knowing Jewish texts was paramount, and we will see in another session when he has to go into hiding under the British that that actually saves his life quite probably. But his father was also a bit of a firebrand. Apparently the Polish authorities required that you registered periodically with the authorities before you held religious services. And his father was going to have absolutely none of that. There was a shul in Brisk. The rabbi was a Rabbi Soloveitchik. If they wanted to have services, they were going to have services. And he periodically got himself apparently into some complex relationships with the law because he simply refused to register their desire to worship with the local authorities. And his sister, Rachel, who later on, when he becomes prime minister and is asked to reflect a lot about their early childhood years, she says that their father raised them with four primary values. These were her words. Number one, respect for others. And we're going to see this come out in revisionist Zionism in just a few minutes. A love of Zion above anything else. Pride in being a Jew. And a faith in the future establishment of a Jewish state. It's important for us to state in 2020, given all the debates swirling around the Jewish world, it was a Jewish state. It was not a Jewish home. It was not Achad Ha'am. It was a Jewish state, which was in some ways, by the way, for Menachem Begin himself, derivative of a newfound Polish nationalism, which was very much in vogue at that time in Poland. And in high school especially, he was very much influenced by teachers who were aficionados of the Polish nationalist movement. And it's pretty clear that some of that actually impacted his way of thinking about Judaism, the Jewish people, Zionism, and a Jewish state. One of the things that it's interesting to think about when it comes to Begin, and I don't have an answer to this question, but I think it's an important one for us to ask ourselves, is why, when so many other Zionist leaders who came from that traditional world broke with that world, did Begin not? Many of the early Zionists, as we know, moved to Palestine and then reinvented themselves, very often changing their name. Ariel Sharon, we already said, grew up as a Shinerman. His family was from Brisk. He wasn't himself from Brisk. But his family had left traditional Judaism long behind and changed Shinerman to Sharon. David Ben-Gurion had grown up in a traditional home, was David Gruen, becomes Ben-Gurion. Achad Ha'am had become had grown up in a very traditional home and becomes very secular, deeply in love with Jewish texts and Jewish tradition. In fact, Achad Ha'am would later recall in his life that after he broke with tradition, with tremendous tension with his father, he used to wake up in the middle of the night sweaty from a nightmare that his father had punished him by not allowing him to look at any of the books that were on his shelf, which is one of the great, beautiful ironies of this Zionist movement. There's a kind of a rebellion against the tradition, but a deep love for the Jewish people. Begin did not change his name, and he never broke with tradition. And why particularly that is not really clear to us, but the fact that he doesn't make that break, whether in leaving behind his European roots or leaving behind his religious roots, is going to have a tremendous amount to do with the kind of person that he becomes and the kind of leader of the Jewish people and of the Jewish state that he is going to become. We said something about the profound Zionism of the house, and I'll just tell you a little bit more about the Zionism. The following story takes place long before Begin is born. As I'm sure most people know, Theodor Herzl dies in 1904, and they want to do a memorial service in Brisk for Theodor Herzl. Not only did they not want to check with the authorities in this particular case, the Soloveitchik family, which is still an extraordinary, obviously, rabbinic family even today, is now profoundly Zionist. The Zionist commitments of the Soloveitchik family, like most of European Jewry back then, were much more tepid, and the Rabbi Soloveitchik of this particular shul at that particular time told Menachem Begin's father when he went to ask permission to have a memorial service for Theodor Herzl in the shul, no, we're actually not into that, you can't do that. So what did Begin's father do? They smashed in the door of the shul, they had the memorial service in the shul, then they left and they closed the door behind them. And again, it's just to understand where Begin comes from, I think it's helpful to understand something about that kind of a story from his father. So his father is a firebrand. He's deeply committed Zionist. And because he's a deeply committed Zionist, he eventually moves his kids, all of them, out of HaShomer HaTzair, which was a kind of a universalist, socialist, youth movement that they were involved in still exists in Israel to a very small extent, and he moves them into the Beitar movement. And his father had said, the reason I'm moving you out is because the Shomer HaTzair movement cares more about non-Jewish socialists all around the world than they do about Jews right here at home or in Palestine. The universalism versus particularism tension that we're all familiar with as being part and parcel of what makes Jewish discourse today what it was, that already goes back to the Begin household when his father took them out of HaShomer HaTzair and put them into Beitar. Now, what is Beitar? What does it stand for? Who created it? What movement it is a part of? We need to talk about that a bit in order to understand where Begin is going to head later in his life. Beitar is the youth movement of the revisionist Zionist movement, which is created by Vladimir Jabotinsky, who later becomes Ze'ev Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was literally a genius. He translated Hebrew poetry into Russian. He translated Shakespeare into Russian. He translated Russian poetry into Hebrew. He knew a tremendous number of languages. He was an extraordinarily powerful orator, speaker. And he has a tremendous frustration with the Zionist movement in Palestine. Jabotinsky is one of the earliest people to say to Jews, look at Europe, this cannot last. This is going to go south. Now, there's no way that Jabotinsky could have had any idea when he said that just how horrible Europe was going to become for the Jews. But he sensed it in his bones. He said to Jews, you got to get out of Europe. This is long before the rise of Hitler. You have to get out because Europe is not going to be able to tolerate the Jew for very long. And therefore, it was critically important for Jabotinsky that the Jews build a homeland in what was then called Palestine. He felt that the labor Zionist movement, which would eventually become David Ben-Gurion's movement, which will, of course, rule Israel with an iron fist until 1977. He felt that they were far too accommodating of the British, and they were far too accommodating of the pacifist ideas that were in Zionism. And he breaks with the World Zionist Organization in 1922 and founds revisionist Zionism. It's very important to remember that when we say something like revisionist history, what we're kind of saying is that didn't really happen. That's not what revisionist means in this particular mode. Here, revisionist simply means he's going to revise Zionism. It is a much more aggressive form of Zionism. It is a much more in-your-face form of Zionism. He's also, by the way, very unabashed about what the goal is. The goal is a Jewish state in the entire British mandate, once the British become the heads of, have the ownership of the mandate. And as you all know, the British mandate included what is now Israel, all the way to the Jordan River, and what is now the state of Jordan, or Transjordan as it was called back then. Jabotinsky had every sense that all of that was the Jewish homeland, and one of the songs that they used to sing back in those days went, Shtei Gedot LeYarden, Zu Shelanu, Zu Gamken. The Jordan River has two banks. This one is ours, and that one is ours as well. And if you look at the emblem of the Beitar movement back then, if you look at the emblem of the Irgun, it has the map that shows the full picture of what Jabotinsky thought the state of Israel should eventually look by. He felt also, Jabotinsky, that the local leadership of the labor Zionist movement was very, very unrealistic in its view of Arabs. And we're going to come back to that in just a minute. I want to actually focus on two texts for a second. I want to focus on the text of the Beitar anthem because it'll tell you a tremendous amount about the worldview of Beitar in which Menachem Begin comes of age. And it will also tell you a tremendous amount about the political party that he will later found, which will eventually become Likud. It starts out as Chirut, then it has a couple of different iterations, and then it becomes Likud, which of course is still a party that thrives in Israel today. So I want to look a little bit at the Beitar anthem, and then I want to read something from Jabotinsky's Iron Will, which he publishes in 1923, because between those two things, you can really get a sense of how different revisionist Zionism was from labor Zionism. What's the anthem of labor Zionism? The anthem of labor Zionism is Hatikva. Now, I am a fairly committed Zionist. The last thing in the world that I'm going to do is make any fun of Hatikva at all. It moves me, it stirs me to my very soul every time I hear it. But you do have to admit, it would be very hard to march to Hatikva. I mean, just sort of imagine the melody in your mind. You can't imagine a military band marching to HaTikvah, right? HaTikvah is a soulful yearning kind of a creation. It's a poem that as long as we gaze towards Zion and as long as our hope has not run out, Od lo avda tikvatenu, liot am chofshi, right? To be a free people. There's a kind of a yearning, a sweetness, an innocence about HaTikvah that Jabotinsky had no patience for. He thought that that sweetness and that yearning and that innocence and that kind of fuzzy-eyed view of the world was never going to get the Jews anywhere. So we're not going to do it in Hebrew right now, but in the English version, the English translation of the Beitar anthem, just read you a couple of lines from the first stanza. It's three stanzas, and I'll read you a couple of lines from the last stanza. And the melody is a kind of a very military marching melody and so forth, which I'm not going to sing to you. But it begins by saying this, Beitar, from the pit of decay and dust, with blood and sweat, shall arise a race proud and generous and cruel. Captured, Beitar, Yodefet, Masada, all places where Jews had defended themselves to the very end, shall arise again in all their strength and glory. That is a very, very different worldview than the worldview of HaTikvah. They're both part of the Zionist story. It's not about which is right or which is wrong, but it's important to understand that that's the anthem that Menachem Begin grows up with. The last stanza says, through all obstacles and enemies, whether you're rising up or falling down, in the flames of revolt, carry the flame to kindle. Never mind, silence is filth. Worthless is blood and soul for the sake of the hidden glory. Again, you can go on. And notice, by the way, the mention of the word revolt there. Because revolt is going to become critically important to Begin once he reaches Palestine in 1942. So you have HaTikvah, mournful, soulful, yearning, almost innocent. And I think every single one of us today listening to this conversation loves that song, is moved by that song, very often finds a lump in our throat or a tear in our eye at that song, as well we should. But it's also important to understand that there was a very different kind of attitude among revisionist Zionists. I want to read you a piece about the iron from the Iron Wall, which he writes in 1923. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs, just because this will explain a tremendous amount about Israel right now today in the summer of 2020. And a lot of what we're going to learn about Begin is going to teach us a tremendous amount about how to understand the country that we either live in or look at, depending on where we situate ourselves. He talks about his view of the Arabs, which is much less naive, he thinks, than the labor Zionist view. And he says this, this does not mean that there cannot be any agreement with the Palestine Arabs. What is impossible is a voluntary agreement. As long as the Arabs feel that there is the least hope of getting rid of us, they will refuse to give up this hope in return for either kind words or bread and butter, because they are not a rabble, but a living people. Part of what he was saying is this idea that you can capture their hearts by bringing roads and hygiene to Palestine. He says, that's ludicrous. As much as they might like having roads and hygiene, would we, the Jews, give up our love for Eretz Yisrael because of roads and hygiene? No. We actually went to Eretz Yisrael when there were no roads and when there was no hygiene. We came there for something else. And he said, the Arabs are just like us. And the labor Zionists who think that being nice to them and building clinics and so forth is going to win them over, he said, that's not how human beings work. You're not taking them seriously enough. And then he says, not till then, till they understand that they can't get rid of us, will they drop their extremist leaders. Don't forget, this is 1923. We're in 2020 now. It's 97 years later. And just imagine, somebody could say this literally today. Not till then will they drop their extremist leaders whose watchword is never. And then he says the leadership will pass to moderate groups who will approach us with a proposal that we should both agree to mutual concessions. Then we may expect them to honestly discuss practical suggestions such as a guarantee against Arab displacement, equal rights for Arab citizens, Arab national identity, and so forth. I mean, just to think, for example, that Golda Meir, when she's prime minister in the 1970s, will be asked, what do you think about the Palestinian people? And she'll say, Eze am Palestinai, right? What Palestinian people? And she'll actually write an op-ed in the New York Times saying exactly that. Here's Jabotinsky in 23, much more clairvoyant, understanding who they are, where the world is headed, and so on and so forth. He says, and when that happens, I am convinced that we Jews will be found ready to give them satisfactory guarantees. This is the right-wing Jabotinsky, so that both peoples can live together in peace like good neighbors. But the only way, and this is the critical part, to attain such an agreement is the Iron Wall, which is to say a strong power in Palestine that is not amenable to any Arab pressure. In other words, says Jabotinsky, the only way to reach an agreement in the future is to abandon all idea of seeking an agreement at present. Again, I just find it extraordinary to think about the fact that those words were written 100 years ago. They could really be written right today. It's exactly the conversation that we're having amongst ourselves as Israelis, that we're having with American Jews, that we're having with the world at large. Really kind of extraordinary. Anyway, Begin joins the Beitar movement, and at a certain point, he is actually privileged to hear Jabotinsky speak. And when he later reflects on this in his life, he said at that moment, he didn't become committed to something. He became transformed. He became almost like in a sacrificial kind of a way, this was the purpose of my life. And he begins to rise up very quickly through the ranks of Beitar in Poland. And he himself becomes a very, very capable orator. Dan Meridor, when I was writing the biography of Begin a number of years ago, Dan Meridor, who worked for Begin and thankfully is still very much alive, told me that when Begin was prime minister, or even before he was prime minister, when he was in the opposition, when word would spread around the Knesset that Begin was about to speak, this is what Meridor said, the offices of the Knesset would empty out. The people that worked in the cafeteria would leave. The people that worked in the library would leave. The people that worked wherever, they would all leave because they wanted to hear Begin. Begin was, in his high point, probably the best orator in the state of Israel, and he learned a tremendous amount of what he learned from Jabotinsky's extraordinary oratory skills. And Begin goes around Poland trying to rouse up people to join Beitar, trying to raise money for Beitar. It says a lot about him that he often slept outside in parks because he didn't want to waste any money, certainly, on paying somebody to put him up. And he didn't even want to impose on people because he said it was a matter of hadar, which we didn't talk about in the Beitar anthem. But hadar means a kind of deep internal sense of worth, a deep internal sense of respect for oneself and for others, which is going to become critically important when he finally rises to prime minister. And he said it's not hadar to go begging people to ask to stay with them. But as he begins to become more and more successful, and this is true in any relationship where there is a master and a disciple, eventually there's going to be some friction, whether it's in the academic world or the scientific world or whatever world. You start out as the disciple of somebody, and then you begin to nip at their heels and maybe even disagree a little bit. Not all those relationships survive, and his relationship with Jabotinsky also becomes extremely complicated. Jabotinsky actually wanted only to engage in diplomacy with the British. He thought that the labor Zionists were naive about the Arabs. He thought they were a little bit naive about the British as well. But one thing that he did not want to do was take the British on militarily. And Begin became convinced, even while he's living in Europe, that that was a huge mistake. That if he wanted to create that Jewish home that Jabotinsky said was going to be so necessary very soon, you were not going to be able to do that simply by negotiating with the British. You were going to have to change phases a little bit. Jabotinsky was utterly opposed, and they begin to be at loggerheads, and Begin even wants to change the oath to Beitar, which therefore would include the right to actually take military action against the British. He and Jabotinsky cross swords in 1936, 1937, and in 1937, he actually leaves Brisk, Warsaw, Poland, that area, and he goes to Galicia. It's not 100% clear why he leaves to go to Galicia. By this point, he's already finished high school. He's already a lawyer, quite actually. And some people say that he had gone to Galicia to seek some sign of kind of early career legal position. Other people think that he went to get some space from Jabotinsky. And other people still think that Jabotinsky sent him to Galicia to give himself, Jabotinsky, some room without this guy nipping at his heels. We don't know exactly, but we do know that the relationship was complicated, though by no means severed. He's going around Galicia, and one day he decides that he will stay at somebody's house. It's the house of a family called the Arnolds. And there's a mother and a father, and there are two twin sisters, 17 years old. One of them is named Aliza. And he's very taken with her. And he writes her a note the next day in which he writes, "My lady." I mean, that's sort of hilarious today in 2020. But they were young, and it was hadar. And if this is a woman that you're serious about, you don't say, "Hi, Aliza, I just met you yesterday." You say, "My lady." So he writes her and he says, "My lady, I only met you yesterday, but I feel that I've known you all my life." She's only 17. He's not going to marry her when he's 17, or she, well, sorry, when she's 17. So he will wait for 2 years until she turns 19, and they get married in May of 1939, actually with Jabotinsky in uniform and in his wedding party. So even though Jabotinsky apparently sends him in 1937 off to the Galicia to create a little bit of a buffer between them, the relationship is never broken, and Begin till his dying day saw Jabotinsky as his master, as his guide, as his mentor, and so on and so forth. But in May 1939, he and Aliza are married, and the very next day they go to Warsaw. We're going to follow Begin's family a little bit more closely, but I will say that now none of the other members of the Arnold family will survive the Shoah. Her parents and her twin sister are going to be killed by the Nazis, as will Menachem Begin's parents and his brother. So when you have eventually the Prime Minister of the State of Israel and his wife walking around, you have two people who are orphaned, and with the exception of one sibling in Menachem Begin's case, their families are utterly destroyed by the Nazis. That figures into the way that they see the world. It just has to, and that's important to know. So they get married in May 39. They immediately go to Warsaw. As I'm sure most of you know already, in the summer of 39, Hitler and Stalin sign a non-aggression pact. That, of course, does not last very long. And in the 1st of September 1939, Hitler invades Poland. Once Hitler invades Poland, obviously, Poland is a very dangerous place for Jews to be. And Menachem and Aliza flee Poland, and they head towards Romania. They didn't make it to Romania, but they head in that direction, and they end up in Vilna. Now, it's super important to mention something now about their decision to leave and to go to Vilna, because Menachem Begin, at this point, is the head of all of Beitar in Poland. There are 70,000 members of the group, youth group Beitar in Poland, and Menachem Begin is at the head of it. And this is now 1939. He's born in 1913, so he's 26 years old. He's not a child. She's much younger than he is, obviously, basically 10 years younger than he is. But he's not a child, and he flees towards Vilna. And the question is, why did he flee? And the question also is, isn't the captain supposed to stay with the ship until the very end? And Begin received a tremendous amount of criticism from fellow members of Beitar when he was in Vilna, saying, you had no right to leave Poland. Now, I mention this only because the question of when the captain leaves the ship is going to come up again in future cases in Begin's life, when he's going to refuse to leave the ship, either a physical ship or a figurative ship. And a lot of people, not everyone agrees about this, not even his family necessarily agree, but a lot of people say that they believe that that doggedness about seeing it through to the end, even at personal danger, was because of the criticism that he'd received early on when he and Aliza left in 1939 to go to Vilna. Vilna's a strange place back then. There's no KGB, but there is its antecedent, which is called the NKVD. And the way the Russians worked back then was they wouldn't come and arrest you. They were much too polite for that. They would issue an invitation to please show up at the police station. So Begin got the invitation, but he decided that he was not interested in accepting the invitation, so he didn't go. And eventually, of course, the authorities showed up at his house, and he's arrested. What's the crime? Zionism. And he is asked, because he's obviously working very hard for the Zionist movement while he's in Vilna, making no pretense otherwise, and he's asked to sign a paper confessing to his being a Zionist. And he says that he will admit to being a Zionist, but he will not confess to being a Zionist. He'll admit it because it's totally true and there's nothing to be embarrassed about. He won't confess it because the idea of confession implies that there's something wrong with it. And I mention this also because this punctiliousness about law and language is going to come up much later in his life with him and Jimmy Carter. Later on at Camp David with Anwar Sadat when they're trying to negotiate a deal, and it's going to drive Carter absolutely up a tree, and it'll be important to remember then that that's not about Begin's reticence to make a deal with Egypt, it's about who Begin really was. In the end, he is actually sentenced to years and years in prison, and he's put into the Lishkiki prison, where he actually doesn't serve much more than a year. He will eventually, once he gets to Israel and once Israel's founded and after the beginning years of Israel, he'll take some time off, and we'll talk about that next couple of times, to write a book called White Nights, which describes his time in prison. And, you know, we imagine that because he became prime minister of the state of Israel, it's kind of obvious that he was going to get out of prison at some point and make his way to Palestine. But we also have to remember that the vast majority of people arrested by the NKVD were never heard from again. And when he's arrested by the NKVD, Eliza has no reason to assume that she's ever going to see her husband again. And the conditions are horrifying. Begin writes about how they would take their hands, run their hands through their hair, and pull out just a handful of lice. They were teeming with lice. And at the same time, he also recollected that on Pesach, they kept four cups of coffee. They were given this horrible watered-down coffee, but they purposely divided it into four cups so that they could do something akin to Pesach. On Yom Kippur, even though they were desperately hungry, probably close to starving, he didn't eat. Now there, by the way, you actually could have justified halachically eating on Yom Kippur, but this was a matter of hadar. This was a matter of respect. This was a matter of showing the Russians it wasn't an issue of halachic nuance here. It was a matter of what made Begin Begin. The whole point of this movement was to give the Jewish people a certain pride in themselves. And if he was going to be hungry, but they were not going to take Yom Kippur away from him. At the end of the day, though, after serving just under a year in this prison, there's going to be a deal between the Russians and the Poles. The Russians are desperate for soldiers. And the Poles agree to let a lot of prisoners out in order to help various Russian endeavors fight Hitler. Begin and Eliza will first flee eastward. They'll be in Central Asia. They'll be all over. The place will actually bump up with his sister, Rachel, who has also fled to that area. And they will reconnect then and stay in touch, obviously, for the rest of their lives. But at a certain point, a young man named Yochanan Bader, who will become very important later on in Begin's life, who was a childhood friend of his, says, you know what? They're actually creating this thing called the Anders Free Army. It's this kind of an army that's drafting people like you that have not been drafted in the regular system, and they're going to help fight the Germans somehow. You should join the army. And Begin actually does that. He joins the Polish, the Anders army. They make their way all the way around. They come through Persia, Iraq, all kinds of things. But he will eventually, of course, make his way to Palestine there. Now, before we get to Palestine, I want to say something about Brisk, which is destroyed during the war. Begin has long since left Brisk. Brisk is destroyed. In October 1942, the Germans go in to take the last 20,000 Jews who are left in Brisk, and they murder them all very, very quickly. The Red Army will recapture Brisk in July of 1944, but by then it's far too late. The story of Brisk as a major Jewish center is completely over. And I think it's also very important for us to remember the world that Menachem Begin lived in and the lenses through which he saw the world in order to understand how he saw Jewish history later on. Those of us who were raised in America tend to say that in the Second World War, the Nazis killed a third of the Jewish people. Now that's technically true. They killed 6 million out of 18 million people. But that actually misses the point, because the crown jewel of the Jewish world during that period was Polish Jewry. And the Nazis kill 90% of Polish Jewry, not 33%. There are 3 million Jewish people living in Poland before the war. There are 3 million Polish Jews. There are 300,000 at the end of the war. Today there's 30,000 or so. Which means that did Hitler win the war or lose the war? It kind of depends on who you ask. If you ask Polish Jewry, Hitler won. Hitler set out to destroy Polish Jewry, and he managed to do that. Begin did not see the world, and did not see the Second World War, and did not see the Shoah as a period in which Hitler killed a third of the Jews. He saw the Shoah as a period in which Hitler wiped out what was by far the greatest Jewish community at that time and had been for hundreds of years. And so later on, many years later, when he's reflecting on Brisk, just read you a few paragraphs of a beautiful speech that he gave. And he called her an Ir Va'em B'Yisrael, which is a biblical phrase, which means a city and a mother. It's a city, but it's much more than my city. It's a parent, it's a mother, it's maternal, it's love, and so forth. Who among us, he says, did not see ourselves as companions to Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, to his son Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, as if we had been with them for all the days of our lives, even those who lived before them, right? Who amongst us did not take pride in the fact that great and righteous scholars sprouted from this city? And who among us does not remember the invasions and changing regimes and the fires and the rebuilding and the suffering of compulsory evacuations during the First World War and then the return to the city? Such, he says, was the city of our youth. She is no longer. We will never again return to her. Her houses stand, her gardens are green, her trees still turn in the fall. Even in school where we studied, that school still stands on a hill. But it is our city no more. Our world is destroyed. It will not rise again. We will never again go to the streets of Brisk, where there are no Jews. There is nothing there for us, only the memory of the ashes that have scattered we know not where. And this is a speech that he gives on the 50th anniversary of the destruction of the city of Brisk, the Jewish population of Brisk. Half a century later, it's actually in the 70s, so it's not 50 years, I forget the number of years. It's in the 70s he gives this speech, and it is clearly heartbroken about the degree to which Brisk is just gone, not only itself, but what it represents. And therefore, Begin will carry this with him to the very end of his days. Now we're going to fast forward again, going ahead to September 1941. He joins the Polish Free Army. They travel through Central Asia, Persia, and Iraq, and he will arrive in Palestine in the spring of 1942. We don't know exactly when he got to Palestine. Amazingly enough, it was either April or May. It's not clear exactly when he arrived, but he was 29 years old. And I just want you to kind of file away in your memory for the next session or two, the year 29, because that number will appear very important in terms of his own life in 29 years once again later on. And where are we when he gets to Palestine? We're, of course, in the middle of the Second World War. We're in the middle of the Shoah. Jabotinsky has died. Jabotinsky dies in Long Island in the summer of 1940. Jabotinsky dies of heart failure. He actually knew that he had a heart condition, but this was about saving the Jewish people. And he worked and he worked and he worked. By the way, Herzl also knew that he had a heart condition. And he worked and he worked, and he dies at the age of 44, Jabotinsky at the age of 60. And I mention this only because I think it's lost on many young people today, how people didn't literally give their lives only in battle. They literally worked themselves to death for the sake of this movement, because they understood that this movement was the key to the survival of the Jewish people. So in the spring of 1942, when he gets to Palestine, Jabotinsky is dead, but Eliza is alive and with him. European Jewry is being eradicated. And Menachem Begin says about himself, looking back, at the age of 29, it was the first time that he ever felt he was home. And as we'll see beginning next time, he will then turn his attention to transforming that sense of being home into creating a national, real political home. And we will pick that up in our conversation when we regroup next week. The British offer a £10,000 reward for his capture, which is roughly equivalent to about $500,000 today. And he therefore, of course, has to go into hiding.